Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5, for autumn semester 2017. Lecture 13, delivered on October 3, 2017. The title of this lecture is Bonds.
Tonight, bonds. Bonds represent debt. Bonds is actually a generic word for a range of debt instruments. If you have a capital project, madam, that's going to require $100 million. You probably will not have cash flow to cover that in your company. So you're going to have a large sum of money available. Now, the two general ways that you could pull off a big sum of money, more than your net income on a given year, would be to sell ownership shares in your company. Sell common or preferred stock. Or you could borrow the money to do the trick. And that means you would issue debt. The upside is that the debt is over, you pay your coupon payments and then you pay your balance back. And the downside is that the bonds, debt has the prior claim. If you don't pay me, I will shut your company down. I will shoot your dog in the hind leg, and you'll be so worried about him that you won't notice that I've just liquidated your company and I've tried to recover as much of what I lent you as I can. It's over for the shareholders. They don't get anything out of that. But in the normal hustle and flow of the business, you meet your current obligations, your liabilities that are coming due at the given time. And if there's money left over, that can be for the shareholders, either as dividends or plowback. But the debt holders have the prior claim on the assets. The shareholders have the residual claim. Almost every time I give a first exam, I ask something about prior and residual claim. I'm telegraphing my punch to you right now, okay? So I want you to understand that clearly, that in business, when we borrow money, the upside is that it is other people's money. It's a fixed amount that we pay back, and then it's over. The downside is that we have to satisfy those obligations. Your bills, you have to pay your electric bill. Your salaries and wages, you have to pay those. And only if you have done all that and then paid your debt holders their interest payments and all that as are due, only then is there any money available to the shareholders. Real world, in my own business, it's a killer because I will do a show and I'll feel like I am on top of the world. I've pulled at a single show $2,500 selling my artwork. And Then I've got all this money, And then it hits me, okay, I've got to pay my bills. I've got to pay for my media presence. I've got to pay the loan payments. I've got a revolving credit with a bank. I've got to make my payments to them. I've got to do this. I've got to pay those workers that were there that have been doing work for me on a as-needed basis. I've got to pay. And then, even worse than that, okay, I sold that one for $500. It cost me only $200. Yeah, I'm ahead $300. No, I'm not, because I have to replace that dang thing. I have to do that again. I have to replace it, so I'm not up $300. You might say, well, that was a rip-off markup. No, because I have to replace the stupid thing that I just sold so I can have it for the next show. So keep this in mind, that all these debts, by the time it's over, on a good day, I've got enough for a Grand Slam breakfast at Denny's. On a bad day, well, then it's just going to be a can of Spam from Schnucks, which isn't bad because the maple bacon flavor is really good. But Understand this, though, that the debtor, that you've got to pay the debts first. And this is true in the tiniest company. Mine is a tiny company. And in the largest companies on earth, we all are bound by the prior claim that our debt holders have. And only after they've been taken care of can the owners, the shareholders, have anything at all. Now, as I had said, one way you can break this down is into bills. These are short-term obligations, like your electric bill. The electric company fronted you electricity for a month, and now you've got to, you issued them a bill, and now they're reminding you, I'll pay your bill. Oh, okay. And it's your bill. You issued it to the electric company on contract. Okay, I've got these other bills that I've got, my salary. I don't pay you every day you work. I accumulate a debt to you. I issue a debt, and then you claim it, and I have to pay a paycheck to you to satisfy that debt. I have to do that before I've got anything for myself. That was another killer. I ran businesses where I had, it was just the worst thing in the world was what we call making payroll. Just that hope to God I had enough money to write the checks for my workers. And then if there was anything at all left in the bank after that, and literally some days I had to write the checks and then rush to the bank the next day and pull money out of my own pocket to pay them. Bills. Those are the short-term obligations. They are the ones that are constantly hitting you. Bam, bam, bam. And then the next ones are the intermediate terms, the notes. Those ones 1 to 7 years. Some companies prefer intermediate because it's over faster. Another reason a company might issue, borrow money in the intermediate is because the project is like intermediate. It's a project that would last maybe a few years. So you wouldn't issue long-term debt for that. You would issue it intermediately. And I'll give you an example of that. In advertising campaigns by companies, a typical ad campaign can last anywhere from one commercial on through to a little cluster, what we used to call the $5 a hollers, on through to what became actually kind of popular in the 1980s, and you still see it some today, the long campaign commercials, 4 years, 5 year campaign. One of the great companies that pioneered this was a coffee company that actually, it was daring in its time, where they mapped out a plan to have a story arc that would go over a period of 5 years. I think it was actually like 3 to 4 years, but it became so huge that it went on much longer. Now, this was an expensive campaign. And so the borrowing that would be required to finance a campaign like that was intermediate term. It wasn't short term. This wasn't the $5 a holler stuff. And it wasn't going to last for 15, 20 years, but it was intermediate. The campaign was called the Loving Couple Campaign, where the first commercial was just this fairly attractive 30-ish guy and who just happened to stumble in and run into a fairly attractive woman in her 30s. And they found out they both like this kind of coffee. And as each commercial part came on, they got to know each other better and better, and they began to have a relationship. They found out about each other's trials and difficulties in life. It was like a soap opera running, an intermediate term capital expenditure. Like I said, ad campaigns are expensive as hell. So they borrowed the money to do it. They laid out for the lenders, this is what we want to do. The lenders, this is risky, but we'll go with it. And it turned out there were other commercials that followed that path through the 90s. And I think you've probably seen a few in the, they're not nearly as popular as they were. And I think in your lifetimes you've probably seen a few. But those are intermediate capital expenditures. Long-term capital expenditures are bonds. We're talking about infrastructure, foundationals, long-term strategic directions of a company that require capital in large amounts. The new factory, the opening up an entire new branch in a new country. In some cases, new facilities for training that are modernized for the new century. Long-term, long-haul stuff would be the stuff that you would borrow long for. The stuff that's going to be fundamental. And like I said, the best way to describe it is, this is the stuff that is strategic plan kind of capital expenditures. These are part of an underlying, it's going to be there for a very long time. When Elon Musk talks about rockets that will colonize Mars, or inner-city rockets that will fire up and land, those are long-haul projects. The companies that are building the generations of chips that you won't see for 10 years, they're doing this now. They have all these generations that are in one stage or another of progress. That whole infrastructure is strategic, lasting over 50 years. They actually have envision even what's going to be here in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. We're that far ahead. That's strategic. That's the capital expenditures. That's the stuff that in some cases you don't even know about kind of stuff, but it's still going on behind the scenes, stuff that will blow you away in the years to come. But anyway, that gives you an idea of what these different debt instruments. When I am a company, I issue debt. That means I borrow. I'm the issuer, the writer. You, the lender, you are the buyer of that debt, the investor, the purchaser of it. Okay? That's how the terminology we use. You are actually an investor. Stockholders, you bought stock in my company, you're an investor. You are an owner investor. You are a lender investor. You're both lending to me. Now, the thing, though, is that here, and I've said this before, now I'm, like I said, I always say things a couple of times before I really hit it on the head, and this is where I hit it on the head. When you, madam, decided that you wanted to have a very, very high-end car, okay, you decided on a Nissan Juke. Okay, have you ever seen one? They're actually cool, but they're not. No, don't say that. They are. I mean, what? You want one of those souls? They call them a soul. And that's an ugly car. It needs to be taken to the compactor, right? Oh, it already was. It's a cube. Okay, anyway, what I'm trying to get at is when you take out a loan as a consumer, whether it's for a house, a car, a student loan, when they calculate the payments, and we're going to do some here today, again, I'm just going to keep layering this until you get everything comfortable with you. But when you do this kind of thing, borrow money, your payments are set so that every payment, part of it pays interest on what's left to owe, and part of it pays down what you owe. We say the payments amortize the debt and service it. Service means the interest. Amortization means the principal. With corporate and government debt, it doesn't work that way. With corporate and government debt, over the life of the loan, all that is done by the borrower is pay the interest. That's all. At the end of the loan, then one last interest payment is made, and the original balance, what was lent, is paid off in one balloon. That's how corporate and government debt works. It's just service the debt through its life. At the end, at the time of maturity, on the maturity date, one last interest payment is made on that loan, and then the loan is paid back. So you lend me $1,000 at 5% interest for 30 years. You pay me only $50 every year for 30 years, and 5% of $1,000. And then at the end, you pay me one last $50 payment, and you give me my $1,000 back. That's how it works. that $1,000 is called the face value of the debt. If I don't say something otherwise, it's $1,000. Always. I don't ever have to tell you that the loan was for $1,000. So if you borrowed $2 million, or let's say $200,000, what you would actually do is issue 200 $1,000 bonds because the denomination of each will be $1,000. You follow? Is it 200? Yeah. Okay, so that's how it works. It's always $1,000. Face value, $1,000. Also, watch out for this. Price and quote are not the same. The quote is 1/10 of the price. So if the price of a bond is $987.50, then I would quote the bond at $98.75. No dollar sign. Don't put a dollar sign, for heaven's sakes. It's not a dollar amount. So if I say quote the bond, you say $98.75. If I say price the bond, it's $987.50. Now, where this came from, I'm not sure. I can't remember sometimes whether I've said something or not. The quoting came from old times, way centuries back, when these giant broadsheets were published every morning in New York City and in the big places where stock exchanges were, like Philadelphia. These broadsheets had these tiny print columns, and there was a lot of bond quoting. And so they made every price 1/10 of it to save a little bit of space on the columns. And that was where the tradition started, and it's still there to this day. I think I told you, I knew one of these years ago, back in the early days of day traders, there was this guy, he thought he was so cool about all this, he was investing. He saw a quote for a bond. He ordered 10 bonds at 97.50. And then he got the bill, and he had a heart attack. He was threatening to sue everybody in sight. They are trying to rip me off for 10 times what I pay, what I was supposed to. No, you moron, that was the quote. That wasn't the price. That was a quote. You ordered 10, 97.5. That means that those were $975 bonds. You ordered 10 of them. Guess what? You're on the hook for $10,000 or more, counting your commissions on that big purchase you made. I'm sure your broker loves you. But yeah, watch it. Quote is not a dollar number. It's 1/10. In the calculator, always put in the money, the dollars. Calculators always might turn the quote into money before you put it into the calculator. I'm going to show you to do these a couple of different times. Let me show you something. Here. Works like this. I'll do a quick bond here. A quick bond. TVX, 6%, 20, oh, let's do 2047. That's the basic information. I don't need to tell you the face value. It's 1,000. That 6% is your coupon. The 6% is a dollar amount against the face value. So in other words, this is every year, if you're the lender, I lend you that money, I get a check for $60 in the bank. At the end of the loan in 2047, the maturity date, I'll get one last $50 check and I'll get my $1,000 check back. That's how the bonds work. That's how they roll. Now, by the way, be careful on this. The maturity is 2047. The term is 30. The term is how long the bond has left. So the maturity date, maturity would stay fixed. But as time goes on, the term would approach zero. So watch it on a quiz, I might add, or on a test rather. I might say, all right, what happens to the price of a bond as the term approaches zero? And we'll cover that in the next lecture. It's really simple. I mean, that's a one sentence. That's a four-word, one-sentence answer on an exam, if you know what you're talking about. Trust me on this. Some of these questions will require two sentences. Some of them will require a very short sentence. But anyway, moving on with this. The face value is 1,000. Now, here's what's happened. This would probably be a primary market bond. Essentially, what happens is you, ma'am, your corporation needed to borrow a huge amount of money. So you come to me. I am what's called an underwriter. Now, I deal in stock issues and bond issues. This is a bond issue. So you are going to, you want to borrow, let's say, $100 million. We work out what interest rate represents the appropriate risk. Okay. We see that you're about a double A bond. What you're going to issue is probably going to be graded double A. So we're going to look out what are double A bonds around par, what's their coupon? We figure out it's about 6%. My investors are you guys there in the front. You will be the lenders. And what I'll do is I'll be the intermediary. I might even lend you the money and then just get the loans to work it out with them. But one way or the other, what's going to happen is this. You borrow the money, you issue the paper, I underwrite, I guarantee that the money will be there, and then you guys put together the syndicate and the investors, get the $100 million together, and then we give it to you in a ceremonial way. You get the $100 million, and then you sign a contract obligating that for the next 30 years, you will pay $60 a year for every one of those, every $1,000 bond, you'll pay $60 a year. And at the end, each one of those little bonds will get a $1,000 check and one last $60 payment, totaling up to $100 million. Now, you might buy, let's say, if they're $1,000, you might buy 200,000 of those bonds, $1,000 each. You might take care of 500,000. You might cover 100,000. But I put it together. That's my job as the underwriter, is to make the transaction happen. And also to make sure that the coupon you pay is what the investors want. So I'm going to talk to the investors. Okay, this is the risk of this corporation's debt. It's not perfect, so you're going to get a little more than. So what are we talking about? You do your research, they say 6%. Okay, so when that bond goes out the door, 6% is appropriate. But what happens over time? Now, this is a long bond, so interest rates are going to move. On a risk-adjusted basis, what happens if over a period of time, interest rates rise on the risk-adjusted basis from 6% up to 7%? Are you investors going to be happy getting 6% when the risk level is 7% now? No. You're going to punish this bond. You'll sell the bond to others. And as selling happens, supply goes up, price goes down. So this bond will then start to sell at a discount to par. Now, par is $1,000. Notice that I wrote 100 there. Get you comfortable with the difference between the price and the quote. In other words, the bond's price will slip below $1,000. Now, on the other hand, if over a period of time, interest rates, the Fed starts getting easy money out, interest rates drop to 5% on a risk-adjusted basis for this kind of a bond, then that's going to make people want the bond. New investors will come in, you'll sell your bonds in the secondary market, and this bond will start to sell at a premium to par. And again, that's $1,000. Nothing really too complicated about it, especially once you see this. And what bothers me anymore is it used to be the case that I could show you bond quotes all the time. But interestingly enough, here's the deal. Bonds, the bond market, and I've said this before and I just keep repeating things, the bond market is not sexy. You're not going to see many bonds go much away from $1,000. Because $1,000, you're going to get $1,000 at the end of the life of the bond if the company's okay, if it's not in bankruptcy. So in other words, you're not going to see bonds going way up and way down. Stocks, there's no limit to how far up they can go or how far down they can go. Well, the zero is the limit. But the bottom line is that the bond market is a quiet market. It's not as volatile, but it's 10 times as large. It's 10 times as large as the stock market. But it is not a sexy market. There's not this chance to make millions overnight. You buy bonds because they are stable, lower risk investments. Now, you can get risk in a bond. I mean, if you buy junk, non-investment grade, we don't say junk, we say non-investment grade bond. You know, you could speculate. There are a couple of different ways you can speculate in the bond markets. But for the most part, bonds are a stable thing. Now, here's another interesting thing. I can't really say this, but for most of you, you're going to buy your own stocks. You're going to do stock and bond purchases yourself, probably through mutual funds. Now, the deal is this. You think, well, I'm going to invest in the stock market, all my money. Probably not. A smart investor has a balanced portfolio. You might buy one mutual fund that's bonds and another mutual fund that's stocks. And what you would do is, if times are really good, you'd maybe have 80% stock, 80% in the stock mutual fund, and 20% in the bond mutual fund. But then if we're going toward a recession, you go defensive. You start moving money out of that stock index and into the bond index. You might go 60% bond in the bond and then 40% in the stock. Now, planners and advisors would say, actually, you should have some cash in there as well. Maybe in good times, 5% cash, in bad times, 10 to 15% cash. But basically, bonds are not just for old people. Bonds are not just for boring institutional investors. They're part of your portfolio, too. Think of them as like a stabilizer. It's sort of like... It's kind of hard to explain, but in your life you have things that you do that are crazy and then things you do that are very normal. And essentially the bonds are the normal, the stocks are the crazy. And it depends upon what kind of a balance. As you get older, you're going to go more toward normal and less toward the crazy, but you're always going to have the balance in there. So don't think bonds are just for old people. Now, very quickly, before I go on, No. Let me do some things. There's one more thing in here that I should bring up. Yield. This is what the market thinks the bond should pay. That's what I was talking about over there. See these numbers, 7%, 5%? Those are yields. This is what the market thinks the bond should pay. Now, right at the beginning, during the original issue, the yield and the coupon should be the same. That's the whole point of getting... See, because if I get the yield and the coupon the same, the borrower gets $1,000 a bond. But if I screwed it up, well, then the bond, what the lender gets wouldn't be $1,000. It'd be whatever the price had moved to. But let me show you. The best way to do this is just a practical example. I'm going to use that bond over there. Let's say, we'll start off, and This is one step simple, and then it turned off on me. Really? Okay. Now, apps, finance, TVM solver. Now, I've already shown you, and you've been doing problems with the in homework and quizzes and tests on getting loan payments and all this. Slight difference in a bond. Let's look at this bond. Right now, the bond has, oh, that's my cat walking across the security camera. Okay. No, seriously. I know which one that is. That's Phineas. Because my other two cats have no tails. They're Manxes. So if it's a long, jiang jiang, that's Phineas letting his tail cross just to irritate me. If it's a short one, that's my Manxes. Anyway. Where the hell? Sorry. 30 years, okay? Okay. Now, let's say that the market thinks this bond should pay 7%. Now, you watch this. Be careful. The I percent, that's always the yield. Don't get confused. You see that coupon over there, 6%? That goes in the payment field as a dollar amount. Don't ever confuse the two. It's the yield that's the I percent. The PMT is the coupon, and it's a dollar amount. Don't put that 6% goes nowhere in this problem right now. Okay? No place to put a 6%. So in this case, I've got a yield that is 7%, okay? Now, what we're going to do is we're going to find the price of this bond, the price value, PV. Now, go. Excuse me here, just a second. Excuse me. Okay, now, payment. This is where you put in the coupon. It's $60. You could even, if you didn't count, sometimes it's a little harder. I could just say 0.06 times $1,000 if you don't want to try to calculate it. The coupon is the dollar amount of the coupon percent times face. But, I mean, most of them you can figure it out yourself. Now, here's the trick, though. Future value. That's the face value. That's your kicker at the end. That's what makes these loans different from normal consumer loans, because the whole balance is paid, the whole principal is paid in one shot at the end. Now go down, make sure you're on end, because coupons are always going to be at the end of the month. And go back up here, price value, and you say alpha sol. $875.91 is the price. Do you see that this bond is selling at a discount to par? Because the market said you should pay 7%, you're paying 6%, we're going to punish this bond. This bond is going to sell at a discount to par. And it's not a negative, that's just these financial calculators. Now, the quote, if I said quote the bond, then you would say $87.59. The quote is $87.59. The price is $875.91. Do you see how, and this is actually a pretty darn steep discount. That's a heavy, it's discounted from, if it's selling at par, that's $1,000. This son of a dog is selling at a heavy discount, because what the market says you should pay is a lot more than what the corporation is paying. So this bond is going to be punished badly. Now watch what happens if the bond is paying more than the market. Suppose that the yield was 5%. In this case, the bond is selling a nice little bonus. 6% in a 5% risk-adjusted environment. Well, let's go up here and put 5 in and see what happens. Go down. Everything looks right. Okay, now, let's calculate the price value again. Alpha, solve. Well, spank me. There it is. Look, see, it's selling at a premium, a darn nice premium to par. $1,153.72 is the price. The quote is, wait, no. You, madam, quote the bond. Say it. No. 115.72. 115.37. 115.37. Okay, the quote is a tenth of the price. And you got to say it fast so that you sound like you know what you're doing. Okay, don't hesitate. Don't show weakness. They smell weakness. Okay, that's what's going on with this. See how it's selling at a premium? Because this bond is paying 6%. The yield is telling us that the investment environment, you need to only pay 5%. So if they're paying 6%, you're going to have a lot of demand for this bond. There's going to be buyers trying to sop up these bonds because they are paying a nice 6% coupon in an environment where they really wouldn't need to do anything but 5%. So this bond will sell at a premium to par. This is the stuff that I could do on an exam, too. If the yield is above the coupon, then the bond will sell at a premium to par. If the yield is, or whatever. So keep that in mind, that just showing me that you know the dynamics of price against the yield and the coupon spread. And obviously, as that spread between coupon and yield increases, the bond moves further away from par. In other words, if I'd put a 4% in there, that bond's price would have been way above. If I had put an 8% in there, then that bond's price would have been way below par. So if I asked you a question, what is the relationship between price and yield? And the price and the spread between yield and coupon, you say the greater the spread, the further the bond deviates from par. That would be the complete answer to an essay question. And when you give me a perfect answer, or almost perfect, secret of grading 400 exams. If you're close, then I am so grateful that I might not notice that you misspelled a word or something like that, or that you said something not quite exactly right. So know that the closer you get to showing me that you understand on a repetitious basis, real understanding comes later. But if the first thing for real understanding is being able to tell me what I want you to say. Okay, now, this is the first round. Now, there's one thing that I was unrealistic about this example. Well, there were two things. Actually, bonds don't pay their coupon yearly. Most bonds pay their coupon in 2 semi-annual installments. Now, there are actually bonds that pay quarterly. 4 annual installments. And there are even some bonds out there, I'm told, and I haven't seen one. Honestly, I haven't. But there are some that actually pay the coupon monthly. So, but the one that you should assume is in play, unless they say differently, is the semi-annual. So in other words, more realistically, what would happen with this bond is that it wouldn't be 30. It would be 30 times 2. So in other words, there would be 60 actual payments in 30 years. And the yield would not be 5% per year. It would be 5 divided by 2% semi-annually. Please don't forget. And one more thing. each payment wouldn't be $60. It would be $60 divided by 2. Okay? So unless you're told differently in a problem or you see it differently in the real world, always assume that the coupons are semi-annual. So the N is twice the number of years, the N is twice the term of the bond. Because what we put in here is how long the bond has left. The yield is half of the annual, and the coupons are half. Now watch what happens. Interestingly enough, it actually affects not too much, but it does affect. Remember this premium of the bond was selling at $11.5372? Watch what happens now that I've made the coupon semi-annual. It's not a huge difference, but it's enough to be noticeable. $11.5454. Oh, not quite a dollar more. But keep in mind, though, if you're talking about a $100 million bond issue, that suddenly actually comes out to be quite a bit of money. Most bonds pay semi-annually. So just make sure that you know that. Okay? Having done this, now I can do the last round of this, which is to make it what really is done. In the real world, what would happen is that we would see TVX 6% 2047 at 98.52, quote, on the quote. That's what we would actually see. The market's going to show us, reveal the price. That's what markets do. They price. What really happens is we work backward to find out what the yield is. That's what really happens in almost any real world circumstance. What you'd be doing is you would be pricing backwards. So in that case, what we would do is we would put in the term is 60 periods, 30 times 2. We would not know the yield. So we would just leave that blank for the time being, and we would put in the price. Remember, you always put in a present value as a negative. Price value, negative, and it would be $985.20. Remember, the quote is only a tenth of the price. Now, the payments would be 6% divided by 2 on $1,000, so the payments would be 60 divided. Everything else would be the same, $1,000 of face value. And we would go up to the I percent, and this is what we would calculate. Now, notice that this bond is selling at a discount. Do you see that? Do you see that this bond is selling at a discount to par? It's selling below $1,000. So what we should see is that the coupon is not good enough. But here's where you have to watch it. Be careful. Alpha Sol is going to give me half of the annual interest rate. It just kills me when I see this done. And back when I would hand grade, I would give partial credit because watch what happens. Alpha Sol. See that interest rate? That's only half of the right answer. I've had so many students, they understand how to do the problem, obviously, but they forgot that what they were getting was a half of the annual because everything I'd done was semi-annual and keying in the numbers. So when you get to that, just say times 2. Just run it to the end of that answer they give you. Say times 2. Whoops. Times 2, and then just put, there's the yield, 6.11% to 2 decimal places. The yield to maturity, YTM, is 6.11%. Sure enough, the market says the coupon is not good enough. That's why it sold at a discount to par. We have teased out what the market's telling us. We have teased out the market's sentiment about what risk this bond has. Now, when this bond was issued, it was very likely that the risk level of the bond was 6%. But something has happened, the macroeconomy or this company or something has pushed the yield up somewhat. And so that means that the market doesn't love this bond as much, so there's going to be selling pressure, which will push it to a discount to par. Now, again, though, most bonds are, I mean, you have speculators who will buy bonds, let's say, at a discount to par, and what they are betting on is that macroeconomic interest rates will go down, or this company's risk will go down, which means that the bond's price will rise. And so they can make some money off that. In a way, these are safer speculations because, I mean, they're not going to swing wildly. So if I buy this bond at a discount of 985, I mean, it's not going to go skyrocketing to $1 million or anything like that. I might make a few bucks off it if this company was having some hard times and then it gets out of them, so its credit risk goes down a little bit, and that means that the market's yield pushes down so the bond's price goes up. I might buy bonds at a discount to par betting that they'll go up in price a little bit. But there are some that are so far in the dirt, they are pure speculative bonds. Like, for example, Sears. I can't remember. I didn't pull it up. I was not successful in pulling it up. Last time I checked, a Sears bond that had a coupon of something like, what was it, like 6.5%, it was selling at $385. I mean, that's just insanely low. There are only two reasons you would buy a bond at that price. One is, you're just insane. One is that you believe that Sears is actually going to pull it out of the fire. They're actually going to come back from the dead, which means that the yield that is so insanely high right now is going to settle back down, and so the bond's price will go up toward par. The other reason you might do a bond that is clearly of a company that's about to die, for $385, if Sears goes bankrupt, what will happen is that the bondholders will simply liquidate the corporation. And they'll divide up what the money that they get for liquidating it among the bondholders. The shareholders are going to get nothing. But you might say, for $385, Sears is going to go bankrupt. They're going to liquidate all of its assets. Now, I am owed $1,000, but I bought a claim on $1,000 for $385. Maybe I will get more than $385 when the smoke clears. Maybe they'll liquidate the assets, and there will be more like $500. To honor my $1,000 claim. So you might bet on a company that's near death that there's going to be more there for those bondholders to get back. Madam, you are dying. It's a bad death. Okay? You ate at Chipotle's. Notice I covered up the mic for that. And, I mean, you know, right now, there are people, you know, bidding on your minerals and your bones and all, you know, your scalp and your glasses. They're bidding around $200. Well, I know that you were worth $1,000. So what I might do is I might buy a claim that cost me $200, betting that when all the smoke clears and your value is allocated I'm going to get close for maybe $500, not $200. So I might speculate that there's more in that liquidation that is going to come out when this turnip is squeezed for all of its blood than we are thinking. That's a reason why you might do this. Okay, now I'm going to do some more of these on Thursday, like this one, but I need to show you a couple of things here. And then at the end, I'm going to give you some information so you can do a nice little online test, a quiz. And I'll give you the information, bond information, and it'll open up tomorrow. Don't let me forget to do that before I call class tonight. I'm constantly doing it. Let me do this, though, real quick. Typically, you borrow short. You issue bills, just working capital. If I need money for just something short term, or if I need a service short term that I'll pay at the end of the month, that's a bill. I issue a bill, I pay it back in 30 days. Now, so investors of all kinds will come in. You're a large creditworthy corporation. You need money for 30 days. You're going to issue what's called commercial paper. Very short money. I don't need my money for 30 days. I'll lend it to you for 30 days for a little scratch that you'll pay me extra for this service. That's called commercial paper. It's extraordinarily common. It's the kind of stuff for investors like me who don't need their money right away, but they don't like to have their money committed for very long. Okay? That's the bills market. Now, the notes market, lenders who lend intermediate, they're usually lenders who don't need money for a few years. The lenders to Netflix. Netflix issued $1.1 billion in notes. That means Netflix believed that it needed the money for an intermediate amount of time, and then it could pay it back because it would have made so much off that money through new things. The lenders would be the kinds of lenders that, okay, they have huge amounts of money. They need it in the longer run. But we can do without that money for 5-7 years. So we lend it out to issuers of notes. And there are a lot of companies. Notes are for middle projects. And the lenders are the lenders that they would prefer to have their money if it's going to be more than 10 years. But if it's not going to be 10 years, yeah, I'll lend it to you. Now, the bond market is an interesting animal. Bonds are long instruments, 20, 30 years. I lend, you borrow from me, you're looking for money that's going to do something that's going to perform at its best over a very long haul. Strategic projects, a new factory, a new way of producing things, new technologies that are going to be enduring. And boy, that's hard now because, I mean, you invest in technologies now and 5 years later, all the money you spent, oh, well, that's old-fashioned. Now we've got this whole new thing. It drives you crazy, but okay. You're talking about infrastructure. That's 2030. But the question is, what kinds of lenders, what kinds of investors in bonds are willing to lend for very long periods of time? These are clearly institutional investors. Very large institutions, families, trusts, things like that. But what kinds of institutional investors don't need their money for 20, 30, 50, 100 years? Got any idea? It's an insanely large market. But who are these? What are those shadows out there that are so large we don't even recognize that they are actually existing? They're on such a scale. And literally, I'm not even being hyperbolic about that. That's what we're talking about, is institutions that can pull $5 billion up from nowhere and throw it out for 30, 50, 100 years. What kinds of investors do that? What kind of investors would that be that don't need their money for that long, for 30 years? Got any idea? Well, there's an interesting thing. Celebrity families. I mean, very rich old families where there is so much money in the family. They don't need it for a very long time because it's intergenerational. As a matter of fact, bringing that one up specifically, when I went up to, I took the finance students up to one of the big investment houses, financial services places, Morgan, in Chicago, 55th floor of the Chase Tower. And they were just sitting there talking about what kinds of clients they take. First of all, they said, well, we're really not interested in anyone who has less than $30 million to put with us. Their average portfolio was something like $150 million. These are families. And it's like they become more than just the investors for the family. They're the handholders. Well, we got our daughters just gotten married. They're going to have, they're planning to have 3 children. And so we got to make plans for those kids that are going to be stringing out 20, 30 years. Well, we got this uncle, he's been found to have this chronic disease. We can manage it, but obviously it's going to take a lot of money over the rest of his life. Those kinds of extraordinarily long horizons are there in those kinds of places, absolutely. Another one, the big 800-pound gorilla. And I've told you this before, and I don't want to bother you too much, madam, but you are going to die someday. But it probably won't be tonight. Now, it could be tonight. You walk outside and a meteor hits you. Ka-chung! You are walking beside her and you look down and you see what happened. And you say, well, that sucked. And so you Instagram it, Laugh if you will. But you will die. But it's not going to be for a long time. So if I'm a life insurance company, I am absorbing huge premiums. All these premiums from millions of people paying their life insurance premiums every month through their payroll plans or whatever, and it's all coming into me. I don't need that because you're not going to die tomorrow, so I don't have to pay a death benefit to you or to you or to almost any. Actuarially, I mean, there's going to be people who die, but there'll be a very tiny portion. So for the most part, I need a place to invest those premiums, those hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in premiums, where it will be paying me interest for many, many years before I ever have to take any of it and perform. So every year, every month, or whatever, I am meeting borrowers who are issuing long-term securities so that I can put my money in a place where I won't have it thrown back in my face 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, or even 20 years. I want a place where it will, on average, be coming back to me after I invest it 30 or 50 years from now. Okay? You understand the idea there? That's one of the most common kinds of investors in long-term securities. Now, here's the other part of it. There are some, in insurance, you have a combination called frequency and severity. Some things are constantly, you're making payouts, little car accidents, fender benders, injuries in life and health and all that. But now there are, and so you have this constant cycle of little things. But in property insurance and casualty, there are some events that are extremely rare. But if they happen, and they will happen, it's not if, it's when, the loss is staggering, beyond imagination in some cases. A good example of that is where we are sitting. You might look down under your seat, you won't see it, But we are sitting near a catastrophically dangerous fault line called New Madrid. It's a little to the east of us. But this almost never creates an earthquake. But when it does, it is unreal what the damage. The last time New Madrid pulled was in the early 1800s. And I had the occasion to read the letters from the people in the St. Louis area up along Illinois. And they were describing it was literally like reading science fiction apocalypse literature. The fires, the smoke, the death, the buildings that came down. And I thought, was this place actually like, was there that much going on out here in the early 1800s? Yeah. What was even more amazing was that they said at the time that the earthquake made the Mississippi River flow backwards. That's not actually what happened. The earthquake actually literally heaved the earth up and threw the water of the Mississippi back north, up toward Canada. And then it came back down like a tsunami, flooded out the croplands. It hit along the major city lines in the area, flooded them out. After the earthquake had killed so many people with the fires and the buildings falling, then there were the floods and the drownings, and there was starvation because the crops were wiped out. Just from something that occurs no more than once every couple of centuries. Frequency, small, extremely low probability. Severity, insanely high. That would be for a property and casualty company. For those insuring those kinds of things, you're getting premiums every year, earthquake premiums. But what you would do is you would want to invest those in extremely long instruments that would not pay off for decades, if not centuries. Another example, a good example, would be the Fukushima reactor. The truth of the matter is, despite what you might hear, modern nuclear reactors are actually ridiculously well controlled, very safe. However, if one of them does go bad, it is just a catastrophic event. Fukushima in Japan was one of those events. We don't even know the long-term consequences, but we do know that the frequency of something like that happening is exceedingly small. But we also know that what could happen if it does melt down is literally, if it melted down through and breached the containment facility, it would melt into the earth until it hit something cold enough, and then it would blow like a massive, dirty nuclear bomb. Okay, one last one. True story. Imagine you've got two gorgeous skyscrapers side by side. Oh, they're just beautiful, gleaming. They're the icons of your city. Now, the probability that one of them would burn and collapse is ludicrously small. It just would not happen once in hundreds of years. Well, if you got two together, the chance of one ever burning and falling would be ridiculously small, so it could never happen to two of them at once. Well, so that's why the Twin Towers in New York City, in Manhattan, only one of them was insured. Because it could never be the case that two could fall down at once until they did on September 11th, 2001. Oops. Frequency and severity. That's all I have for you.